Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's installment of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. I see most of you are familiar faces, but a few new faces as well, and we welcome all of you. Who's here for the very first lecture? Nobody? Everybody's all veterans? Okay. Well, I won't have to give you a lot of background, though, but I always like to kind of pat ourselves on the back a little bit. I mean, we've been doing this same program for 35, how many months?
40 years.
Yeah, when I say we, I wasn't there 4 years ago. Bob Berman was 39 years ago, and we've kept this same program moving forward, and it's a very unique program because we do it with all volunteer labor. We have no paid staff, and we really don't offer the speakers any recompense other than buying them a meal, you know, which isn't a whole lot. But nevertheless, we get exposed to an amazing array of very talented speakers, get exposed to a lot of great, intriguing ideas. And that is our mission as a small institution that we are, is to really provide a forum, as the name suggests, for presenters to talk about their ideas, their worldviews, their perspectives, so that we can learn about them, add them to our repertoire. And unlike almost every other organization I know, there is no particular ideology or point of view that this organization is trying to promote. Our point of view is simply to make exposure to all these different ways of looking at things available so that people can have access to them, be informed, and make their own conclusions. And as I said, we do all this by volunteer labor. And with regard to volunteers, I'd like to ask Mr. Rob Olson to step forward here for a minute. Rob has served as our president of this organization for, what, 3 years?
4 years.
4 years. 4 years. And the president, as I'm sure any of you who've been around the organization knows, is kind of the one that where the buck stops. You know, like you try to delegate and get all these other assignments done, but at the end of the day, if nobody picks it up, it's up to you. And Rob's been that guy for 4 years that makes sure everything gets done, makes sure that the speakers are contacted, remember it's their night to speak, that we have all the right equipment here, and that we line up and schedule the speakers. And Rob is going to be taking a well-deserved break and stepping down as president. And so I'd like for us all to have this opportunity to honor him for his service. And if you really enjoyed his lectures, you owe him a great round of applause. And this is, we call it the academic calendar. So with May and graduation time coming around, we will be taking a hiatus over the summer months. But we'll be back the second Tuesday in September. And stay tuned for the schedule. We're still working hard on that, lining that up. But this will be our finale for this academic year. And I think you're in for a treat with regard to that, because we have, yes, sir.
I just wanted to ask, you don't think it'd be possible to have a bonus session with plagiarism, the one we missed, when it really didn't rain, 10:30 at night. So
we're going to have that in the fall. We're going to have that in the fall. Who knows the date for that? Is it the
8th?
Of,
no, it's not. It's
okay. Well, I didn't mean to ask.
Fourth Tuesday in September?
I didn't mean to ask school, but, you know, I was really looking forward to it.
Yeah, we welcome the comment, yeah. Yeah, he did the speaker's call, and we didn't have subpoena power over him, so, you know, we were here.
This organization was started, the reason that we don't meet in the summertime was that the professors don't work in the summertime. They go and they go on vacation.
Sure.
And it was always, we always were very strict. You had to be professors of philosophy, and we've broadened it since then.
Yeah.
But in those early days, they had to be professors of philosophy, and if they're not working, they're not here. So
yeah,
we close down in the summer. That's the reason we close.
If anybody has a subscription, we'll certainly extend, you know, through that cancellation and give you an extra session on your subscription because of that. But for now tonight, we have as a presenter Mr. Bert Tarley, who I've been fortunate to know for some 4 or 5 years now, since he moved to Dallas. Bert's had a very interesting life and career before becoming a Texan in the Dallasite. He's a native of Canada, and along the way, spent some time in Thailand and India studying Eastern philosophies and ways of being, and has matriculated at a number of institutions, including some non-traditional ones such as Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado, and California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. He spent time in San Francisco, and his work is in the area of psychology and coaching and organizational development. So he is an executive coach, a life coach, and works with organizational leadership teams on their team building and bonding and so forth. But also was one of the active founders of the Integral Movement, the Integral Theory Movement, founded in the wake of Ken Wilber's Sex, Ecology, Spirituality in 1995 and the early 2000s, and was part of the original organization of the Integral Institute in Boulder, Colorado. Bert's going to be speaking to us tonight on the subject of managing polarities, and I've heard a version of this talk at another group called Integral Dallas, and I think you're in for a treat. You'll find it very interesting. So without further ado, I give you Bert Tarley.
Good evening, y'all. Get my Texan on here.
Y'all all.
All y'all.
Y'all all.
Okay.
Y'all was singular.
All y'all. So, I am from, anybody know where Prince Edward Island is?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, the land of lobsters and mussels and all that. I like telling Texans that it's true. In the summertime up there at McDonald's, we have McLobsters. But I've been in the States for most of my adult life, and I just joined your tribe about a year and a half ago. I can't say
that. Hey!
Yeah, it's an American.
I like your tribe.
We have a good tribe as well, exactly. So as David said, tonight what I'm going to do. By the way, I noticed the PhD on the diploma, it's always Doctor of Philosophy. Doesn't matter what discipline you go into, just as a little aside. But I'm going to talk to you guys about polarities. How many of you guys are familiar, a few faces here, with polarity management?
You.
So, the idea is that there are a lot of things in the world that meet each other over time if we are able to make sense of them. Let me see if I can make sense of this and see if this is going to work for me. What do we see here?
Two faces or a base, depending.
Awesome. How many of you see the vase first? How many of you see the faces first?
Faces first.
We have interesting preferences around intentionally ambiguous images and what we tend to focus in on. What do we got here?
Which?
Young woman.
How many see the young woman? How many don't see the young woman? Okay, not to see. Good. So can somebody describe the young woman to the people who don't see her?
She's looking away to the left and looking at the back of her head.
How many see the old lady?
Yeah, we're looking over her shoulder.
How many don't see the old lady? Okay. Can we describe the old lady? A lot of people don't see her either.
I have to make a well, if I want to see her.
Oh, okay.
Big jaw, big nose.
She's got an aging nose. Okay, so look at this. So the old lady has a mouth right here and a chin. Her nose has a little hook in it. And the young girl has an ear where the eye of the old lady is. And that's her nose right there. And that's her chin. Everybody see both of them now?
Yeah.
Oh, now I see the old woman.
It was only a matter of time.
I finally saw the old woman.
What's this?
You know what I had to do? Get rid of the little nose. When I put my finger up and got rid of the little nose, and the old lady came out.
Right, just like that. Cool. Yeah. What do we got here?
Frog. love horses.
Oh my God, I love that. Yeah, so polarities are all about perspectives we take on things that can be both one way in one perspective we take and another in another moment. All depends on how we attune our perceptions. How about this? So what? Upside down. So perspective taking is all about what polarities is all about. How can we take as many perspectives as possible, especially when we start including other dimensions beyond the present? What do we have here?
Baby.
Yeah. Anybody see the baby? Anybody not see the baby? Can you describe the baby? Anybody who sees it?
The back.
The feet?
Yeah, do now.
And the head. So this is a young expectant couple contemplating the birth of their child. So you bring in time with this as well. Since we're at Alphenix, I thought this was apropos. Couple looking into their youth. When she entered his life, he's remembering her, the chalice, the bottle of wine, the tequila, the whole rest of it. Oh, well.
Wow.
That jumps right out, back and forth, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Silhouettes and straight on, simultaneously.
Very interesting.
So polarities play with things that develop into almost paradoxical dimensions and images. If I were to say to you, the more things change, the more you know.
The more you know, you don't know.
Exactly. If I were to say in a complex way, sometimes adding extra capacity to a system reduces overall performance. What's a pithy way of saying that? Sometimes adding extra capacity to a system reduces overall performance.
Less is more.
Bingo! All right, exactly. So paradoxical statements.
They mean expand to fill the space available.
Now we get into thermodynamics and all that stuff. So paradoxical statements and polarities that comprise them are the embracing of apparent opposites in ways that make sense and that have particular utilities. So they've always existed over the course of time. There's something that has been around forever, but certain meaning-making systems tune into them more than others. There's almost a developmental dimension to enjoying them and appreciating them. So Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great, had a prior book called Built to Last, where his whole basic frame was based on the yin-yang symbol, and the core that he had was continuity and change itself, the beingness in the dimensions of life, and becoming something next as we develop into that, and how both are critically important. So many, many years ago, there was the weighing out of these complementary energies and how we create. If we, David was saying, we are not an ideological system, but in most cultures and societies, we're trying to instill aspects of what's good, true, beautiful. This is how we tried to measure that out many years ago. And polarities are this kind of dance around it. You're going to see what a polarity map looks like in a second. This will make more sense. But the idea is that the interplay, the measuring, and the working with and operating from the perspective of these polarities is an ongoing dance that we have to continually pay attention to so that life is not out of balance. So Taoism, 2,500 years ago, the yin-yang symbol itself. Anybody ever read The Philosophers, The Passion of the Western Mind? Maybe not. Okay, it's a great, since this is the Philosopher's Forum, it's a book that really begins with that beautiful picture of Raphael where you've got Plato talking about the ideas and the ideals, looking up, his hand is gesturing to the heaven, and his main student Aristotle is gesturing to the ground about the animate world that he looks in. And Passion of the Western Mind goes on from that to look at how representations of the ideals and manifest reality have danced with each other over the centuries. So it's all yin and yang, Christianity, law and grace. Sharing is a way to manage yourself and care for yourself, care for others. Both are essential. You can't, as an instrument of service, do much for somebody else if you are not a finely honed tool. So one of the biggest polarities in the world is what's always right in front of us, which is the masculine and the feminine. And by that we mean the energies that dance through males and females, men and women, but that are not exclusive to males, females, men and women. We all have masculine and feminine energies, which are represented by these lists of respective qualities and characteristics that relate to them. If I were to say to you, in terms of masculine, feminine energy, what kind of energy does Maggie Thatcher have?
Masculine.
Right on. How about Michael Jackson?
Feminine.
Yeah. You know, so we can be one particular sex, but our energy can be sometimes its opposite. One of the things that goes on, Carl Jung said this is the core polarity in the psyche and the nature of the whole universe. Going to a hardware store or anywhere else, you've got male and female parts, masculine, feminine energies, and it gets broken out here into dynamic and static aspects of each of these. So when you think of beginning at life, this is the energy of the mother, the goddess, the whole way of securely holding and nourishing and giving life in ways that are unconditional. No distinctions are being made about who deserves what or who doesn't. It's just this energy of giving. But as with each of these, there's a downside. The negative dimension of holding is holding too closely, consuming, devouring. But this is in a mirroring relationship with the dynamic masculine energy, which has to do with basically the hero, going out, whether we're 2 years old, a teenager, whatever point in life, and looking at ways that we can take new ground in terms of territory, career, our understanding. But this is very much individually focused. The downside of this goes all the way into narcissism, criminality, you know, whatever I want is what's right here if it's not careful. So it goes through a sort of fiery initiation to join a static masculine. This is the code and the energy of order, structure, rules, standards, expectation sets, what we should be doing according to what does create good, true, and beautiful in the system. Of course, we can also join whatever system this is. This could be the Hell's Angels or anything else, but it's the established code that we take membership in. And then when this seems like it gets too ossified, the downside being kind of like rules for their own sake, which get overbaked. Then there's a breakout from this energy into the dynamic feminine, which is all about creativity, spontaneity, play, everything that has to do with getting away from being confined and enjoying the dance of life. The downside of this, of course, devolves into addiction and all of those kinds of unhealthy dysfunctions. And then there is a rebirth, and it goes back around the whole thing. This is an infinity loop, which is what we'll see polarities are consisting of. So these have really hit the scene in about the last 50 years. After the Second World War, the businesses that were looking at the advent of globalization were recognizing that the old energies of the cognitive rational processes weren't really sufficient to look at things that needed a little more complexity to figure them out. So let's start, though, with the value of either-or thinking, as opposed to both-and. It's essential to understand all sorts of things. So how do you spell? How many ways are there to spell cat in English? Just one, right? Either you say C-A-T or you're wrong. Mathematics, 4 plus 4, pretty simple. So let's see how well we know our history. Who was the conqueror of Mexico?
Cortez.
Cortez, yeah. We're right next door. This is northern Mexico, right? Texas?
Florida?
Baja. Mm-hmm. So science, of course, gravity is the answer here. Morals, many cultures and religions, murder is. Wrong. That would be the right answer. It's wrong. Whereas over here, if we over-focus on both and thinking and reject either or thinking, we can't do all those things that we just did over there. So either or thinking is very important. We're going to look at both and thinking with polarities, but before we do, we want a presence and give proper due to the value of either or thinking. And there are a lot of ways at looking at these, whether it's a problem to solve or a polarity to manage. Problems to solve are not ongoing. Polarities are. There's an end point to a problem to solve. It's either this or that. With polarities, there's never an end to looking at mercy and justice. There's always a weighing out and a balancing of those, depending on the life conditions of the system and how those energies are being, are serving that system or not. So these are independent alternatives. These are interdependent alternatives. These ones stand alone by themselves. These ones need each other in that infinity loop over time. So mutually exclusive opposites down here, should we promote Bill or not? Very simple, it's one or the other. Over here, we see there are polarities between the value of tough love and gentle love. Looking at the value of the individual, looking at the value of the team. Is it more important to pay attention to cost or quality? It's got to be both if you want to be successful. Competing and collaborating, work and home. Problems to solve have one right answer. Polarities need both. My opposition and I are not only both right, we are dependent on the other's truth over time. So I'm getting a bit of a sense of this. This is starting to look at what a polarity map will look like. There's going to be one value on the one side in the middle here. Here it's problem solving as a value. And here is polarity leveraging. So the upside of problem solving is technical and functional needs. The upside of both and thinking with interdependent variables is adaptive and sustainable over time. Up here you have the higher purpose statement, what makes this whole system work. Here, if you don't manage it well, is getting an inefficient system. Shows the downsides when you over-focus on one to the neglect of the other. You'll get the downside of that one you're focusing on, then you'll get the downside of both of them. Over here, too much problem-solving leads to polarization. We see that all the time in the debates we have in Congress and the political arena. One side is propagating one solution, one answer. The other side is saying the opposite. We have polarization. So not unsustainable outcomes. Here, if we only bring both and thinking at times when we need to actually problem solve in an either or way, this becomes analysis paralysis on this side. Doesn't work. So it's out of context. It's important to understand what the issue or tension or dilemma is to see whether we apply either or both and thinking, or sometimes both.
Could you give some examples?
Make
it clear.
Of which one?
Of any of all of them.
Sure. Coming right up to those, actually. Give you some here. I'm going to jump through some of these things. First thing is, polarities and dialogue are really based on principles that we want to work with. Quality, empathy, and looking at our assumptions. So sometimes we begin an exploration of polarities by recognizing that everybody's perspective is true and partial, especially my own, whatever thing I'm believing in. And when I am in a conversation, ideally a dialogue where we are seeking truth, if I get a little tightened up, that's a good time for me to start exploring my assumptions and see why I'm feeling as tight and contracted as I am. I'll notice what arises and actually try to take a perspective on that if I'm able to presence myself well. And from that, try to lift myself up a little bit and have others do the same so as not to be in a mud fight between either or thing. So watch the thinker as a kind of witness, noticing what I'm thinking about, and actually try to feel into what I'm experiencing as I'm doing that. So this F. Scott Fitzgerald quote, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas at the same time and still operate normally without getting tilted by the whole notion of both things together. How do we open and expand ourselves to enjoy that? We always, with these polarities, with these interdependent pairs, have preferences. And some choices are easy, some aren't. There's always a tension between them, representing our values and fears. The five C's that these help with, as you can see, are things that are complex and need a lot of different energies brought to it, change efforts, conflict areas, chronic issues, and in our complex world, cross-cultural, it was a lot simpler when there was homogeneity in the culture and society. Now there are a lot of different energies that have different truth claims and narratives associated with them. So in terms of examples, the core one, when we really begin, is what's the success of breathing? Do I inhale or exhale? It's kind of the wrong question, right? You kind of need both over time. How to really make sure that both are part of the package. I won't get into how in Western society we kind of self-ventilate all the time and don't breathe deeply. But this is the greater purpose, always is above these two. If they're managed well, they'll thrive. If the polarity isn't managed well, things kind of fail. This is the virtuous circle of these working well. This is the vicious cycle going down to failure. Oxygen in, when there's too much, sometimes I'll get audience to take a deep breath in and then exhale. You got to do that to get rid of it. And this is your infinity loop. It's the most simple way of looking at it. Likewise, to be healthy, can't really see this greater purpose statement, is we know that we have to balance activity and rest. What happens when there's too much activity? Well, we end up getting achy muscles and we get exhausted down here. But we also have to tone the muscles. If we do it well, then we're getting stimulated, we're building muscle mass, whatever else. If there's too much rest, we atrophy, get tired and lazy. But rest also allows us to replenish, rejuvenate, and get back into the right kind. So this is a major balancing act. The higher level of performance you get to, more finely honed this balance is. That's what it's not managed well. Stability and change is one of the core polarities to manage. There are what we call tradition bearers who tend to prefer the side of the way things are now and have been in the past. When change efforts come along and people are talking about all the things we want to do to create novelty and new emergences in the world, it will really upset people over here when we look at what's going to be the downside. So the way these work is if I favor stability for these reasons, these are the positive values that come from being stable and maintaining the status quo. When I look at the prospect of change, I'm going to see its downside. That's kind of the way polarities work. If my preference is this side, I'm going to resist change a lot because I am going to believe it may lead to this. Likewise, if I am for change, what I see when I look at my opposite interdependent value over here are the things that seem to be keeping things back. So when we work with polarities, we try to honor each of these four areas rather than exclusively focusing on just the ones that are our preference. Sometimes we will give people these in workshops and ask you to look at, with all of these interdependent pairs, which ones you tend to prefer, just knowing yourself as a person. Do you tend to focus more on task or relationship? Candor or diplomacy? Confidence or humility, which is the sign of a fifth level leader in Jim Collins's. Critical encouragement, control, empowerment, structure, flexibility, logic, creativity. These are some of the examples, and there's many, many more of these. But people, we were talking earlier about the Myers-Briggs type indicator. It's a classic polarity idea. How many, if we think of extroversion and introversion, how many of you consider yourself introverts? Introverts. How many extroverts? More philosophy type, yeah. Fewer of that in here. More thinking types would be in here.
I did it wrong.
You're an extrovert.
I'm extrovert.
I was going to say, I was going to question that, Justin.
We know that.
They
know
that. Well, sometimes I notice what I've found out that I am somebody what's called a gregarious introvert. So I like to be introverted a lot of the time, but when I'm around other people, I get pretty animated. So it can be a little bit of both sometimes. These are some examples about styles that we see in leadership and how, when we're aware of them, we can help other people become familiar with those and see how we can strengthen our opposite sides. The idea here, when we're working with organizations, is we want to develop leadership, we want to develop organizations, and what's been found over the last 30 years or so is that organizations who manage polarities well tend to do better in terms of performance, whatever the metrics is they're being assessed on, usually bottom line results and satisfaction surveys. And of course, task and relationship is built out here to include what you see on the sides on a polarity map. Whoops. Action steps and early warnings. So when you have the values that represent the upside of a task here and the upside of a relationship here, action steps are things that you can actually get people to do that will build and develop these upside values. And these are the things you look for on the downside, warnings that will let you know that you're at risk of over-focusing and getting the downside of that polarity. Some more illustrations in terms of the various leadership polarities that people work with ongoingly, oftentimes thinking. So if I looked at responsibility and freedom, let's say in the socio-cultural political arena, which one tends to be more democratic and which one more Republican?
Democratic.
Do you agree? Generally, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that has a lot to do with what we value in terms of parts and wholes. Has anybody ever heard of conscious capitalism?
Sure.
Okay. So this is something that we were doing for that organization, just looking at the relationship between, you know, if you look at the good of the whole, then these energies tend to be more important as values. If we look at liberty, these sides tend to show up more important for us, depending on our preferences. Of course, there's no absolute difference, but just as a preference, if we had to do that. And the downside of over-focusing on these energies is what we will get. The downside of focusing on the part side give us these not so good outcomes. This is how they sort of develop over time. When one becomes, down here you've got the part, the individual, as part of the family, and then the greater purpose is a good healthy family or team, and then that comes into relationship with the larger scale, an organization or a neighborhood. So then the organization is in relationship with the community goes up and is in relationship with the country, goes up with humanity altogether, nature and spirit. So it shows the scales of the way these interdependent pairs operate throughout nature in all dimensions. kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we thrive? Trying to bring these into balance and respecting the perspective of the other side, knowing that needs to be done. But it's a tricky thing when we see things as needing a certain kind of dose of ingredient, the other side sees the other side. We don't have a really good way of talking about that at this point. We also have what we call not only polarities, but multilarities. So that means there are four interdependent. And these can complexify into this here is the integral view where we have interiors and exteriors, parts and wholes. This here is a map of individual incidences of things, collective incidences down here, interiors here, exteriors there. So these are the things we have. I'm going to skip over this a bit. It gets a little complex. And ends up looking like nothing at all. Like the void.
Maybe you need to aim it at the computer.
Oh. I have it up.
Ghost
machine. Whoops. Wow.
And that's where you are.
That is where I am. Back to the beginning. So we had a malfunction in the power plant system. I'm kind of skipping over this quickly because I want to get you guys down to do some fun stuff around. I don't want to stay there. Wow, so this is the one that kicks it out.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Good. See if I can kick it out before it fails completely on me. Isn't that?
Maybe you go to that other editing screen.
It can't even escape and get out of it. Or?
Is it the last one?
Another channel. Meteorologist is in the back, yeah. And that's your update to Windows 10. And
they
wouldn't let her out of the system until she updates.
I hope. Buy an upgrade or else fail. One of the main things I notice in the work I do, working with not only leaders but people in general, is the preferences we have when we feel strongly about something and we're kind of pushing our perspective or our position, or listening closely to somebody else, is do we tend to prefer candor, the upside of which is kind of straightforward, direct, honest communication, or diplomacy, which is much more hesitant, cautious, listening more closely. As a group like this, how many of you prefer candor? Candor, yeah. Diplomacy? Yeah, it's interesting, right? Well represented. So just to be aware of that, to know that there's something right about developing, depending on the situation, the upside of both of those and noticing the downside. Yeah, if I am over-functioning on candor, I can become harsh, overbearing, intense, not really listening well, being right, being the knower all the time. But if I over-function on the side of diplomacy, I can become kind of a basic floor mat, wishy-washy, too loose, not really taking a stand for the things that I should. So in terms of a sort of freedom pull here, this here is the up energy of what we have on the freedom side in the political arena, the Tea Party. You know, taking a stand, and what's down, what's seen as the downside on the other side, well, what's seen on the other side altogether is the downside. Just looking at government being only big and overbearing, and that is what needs to be gotten rid of to make this happen. Likewise, on the other side, if I am part of the Occupy Wall Street movement, I am going to be looking at the downside over here, which would be the responsibility side, the freedom to have whatever competition will allow me. And I will see that that creates all the problems of inequity and inequality of income, distribution, and all the rest. So we end up having these food fights. And both are half right, both are half wrong, if you will. The upside would be if we could have a conversation and look at how those two can dance, then that would help thriving democracy. If we could stay away from labeling the other side from only being this. So here is a big one in terms of how do we respect one another. If this is conditional respect on this poll, what do we suspect the other side is?
Unconditional.
Yeah, unconditional respect. And both sort of need each other in terms of any kind of human interaction system. So conditional, people are respected for what they do, good work is identified, improvements can be made, there are consequences to things. Unconditionally, we love people just for being who they are. They don't have to do anything at all. It's sort of that basic mother, maternal, ecstatic, feminine energy. People are loved and listened to. If we overfunction on the conditional respect side, then we have all sorts of judgment going on. And over here, unconditional respect, everything having to do with people really not being held accountable for anything. So this is similarly the same energies to do with gentle love, tough love, what we sometimes call feminine compassion, masculine compassion. A lot of the work I end up doing when I see couples is they'll come in and it's such a kind of archetypal complaint I get. I will get the father or the husband saying, oh my God, the reason we are having this problem called a teenager is you are letting him, her get away with murder. And she'll say, well, you're one to talk. You're a damn Nazi. You know, he or she can't do anything at all. You're pushing things down on them all the time. And they're both seeing the downside of each other's preferred pole. And it's really difficult to see and trust that there's an upside to both of these. Let's see if I can get this to work. This here is a great remark on polarity thinking by Martin Luther King. Now, we only have the computer here, so I'm not sure how much sound we're going to get out of this. We don't have any speaker. Let's see if we can hear this over the Mexican music. Buenos suerte.
Is that some of our philosophers got off base. And one of the great problems of history is that the concepts of law and power have usually been contrasted as opposites, polar opposites. So that love is identified with a resignation of power, and power with a denial of love. It was this misinterpretation that caused the philosopher Nietzsche, philosopher of the will to power, to reject the Christian concept of love. It was the same misinterpretation which induced Christian theologians to reject Nietzsche's philosophy of the will to power in the name of the Christian idea of love. Now we got to get this thing right. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best. Power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love.
Isn't that a nice kind of both-and sensibility? To because usually there is sides being taken around that ongoingly. So power without love is reckless and abusive. Love without power is sentimental and anemic. So power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice. And justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. That's a beautiful political sensibility around polarity thinking. If it's managed well, and if it's not managed well, so if I tend to be on the mercy side, accountability looks to me like blaming the victim a little bit. If I'm on the justice side, forgiveness looks to me like tolerating abuse and weakness, if I'm not careful. So this here is a Pepsi challenge test. It's a quote to see who can guess who said this. I'm for the truth, no matter who tells it. I'm for justice, no matter who it's for or against. I'm a human being, first and foremost, and as such, I'm for what benefits humanity as a whole. Any guesses?
One person.
One person? And what's significant? So who we got here? Uh-huh. And what's the backdrop? Close to, yeah, Mecca. He went to Mecca. He became, in jail, he became a Muslim and joined, the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is not the statement he made. Sorry? Nation of Islam. I'm sorry. Nation of Islam, exactly. And became a follower of Elijah Muhammad. And before that, he wasn't making statements like this. But after Mecca, he found himself in prayer with people of all races and all kinds. And this became his new sensibility, for which he was basically killed for. So he felt like he was betraying the one true way. And this here is a statement that is problematic to our mindsets when we're fundamentalist. It's offensive. So that's a polarity that becomes a polarization. Anybody know who? How much time do I have left? Not much.
Keep going.
Keep going a little bit? So we had a very interesting thing here. I want to play a clip. Anybody know who Andrew Sullivan is?
Yes.
Big blogger. Just came back. Just had a big piece in the New York Magazine. Democracies end when they are too democratic, right? So too much of a good thing, like in any of these polls, becomes destructive of its own ends. So he gave this really great critique of, as he sees it in our time now, we are being threatened, in his point of view, by a demagogue, what he thinks is a demagogue in the personage of Donald Trump. So very upset about this, and he writes this long article, but he has a very interesting couple of things that he points out in it as to how we may have gotten to this place. And wish me luck on listening to this guy here.
Horse race, a brief one, I promise, to look at the substance of how Donald Trump pulled off this incredible presidential upset. I was really struck by a cover story in New York Magazine by Andrew Sullivan, the pioneering blogger, who's also in the past been the editor of the New Republic. He's written for Daily Beast and Time Magazine and the New York Times, kind of went into semi-retirement. He was a lifelong conservative who then became a big fan of President Obama, and now he is just appalled by Donald Trump. Now, in his very smart, analytical way, he just completely and totally eviscerates Trump.
I don't think that's
right. I don't agree with much of what he says. He ends up, in a kind of an overheated way, saying that Trump is a threat to Western civilization and all of that. But embedded in this long magazine article was what I thought was really good insight into the connection that Trump made with many Republican voters that, looking back, was missed repeatedly by the media, and even today, I don't think the media still fully get it. So let me just read you a little bit from this Andrew Sullivan piece. Much of the newly energized left has come to see the white working class not as allies, but primarily as bigots, misogynists, racists, and homophobes, thereby condemning those often at the near bottom rung of the economy to the bottom rung of the culture, as well as struggling white man in the heartland is now told to check his privilege by students at Ivy League colleges. These working class communities already alienated here, how could they not, the glib and easy dismissals of white straight men as the ultimate source of all our woes. They smell the condescension and the broad generalizations about them, all of which would be repellent if directed at racial minorities. Now, it's kind of a cliche to say that Trump speaks their language. Trump connected with these people who we shorthand call working class, the white working class, because he understood how seated they were, not just about economic anxiety, losing jobs while international trade deals are happening on and that sort of thing, but also being on sort of the losing end of the culture wars as minorities and liberals and others have kind of won the argument, gotten their way on everything from same-sex marriage to arguments over abortion and things like that. So I think when media, you know, write their histories or look back at how Trump did this, and particularly looking ahead to the fall campaign, and could Donald steal some of these working class people who used to be Democrats or may lead Democrats from Hillary Clinton, I think it's worth examining. There's a cultural aspect as well as an economic aspect to these voters who are so disaffected and so angry at the system, at Washington, at the GOP establishment, certainly at the Democratic elite, who they feel don't understand them and view them, you know, look down their noses at them, and at the media establishment. And the problem here is that many, many prominent journalists live in a bubble. They live in Georgetown or the Upper East Side of Manhattan or Santa Monica, and they don't have much contact with these working class folks, and many of them have admitted that. And this ought to be on our agenda now, to better understand these people who are part of America and who could possibly help decide this election.
So does anybody know the book, It Can't Happen Here? No? Sinclair Lewis? Sinclair Lewis.
Sinclair Lewis.
It's really a talk about the way in a lot of parts of the world, the United States is a relatively new democracy, it hasn't been around that long, but in a lot of other parts of the world, there have been, and this Andrew Sullivan goes back to Plato. It's fascinating to learn that in the Greek state times, democracies were being experimented with, and when they came to their logical end, which was sort of complete equality, complete tolerance, complete acceptance of almost everything that was diverse, different, even criminal, that then a tyrant, a demagogue, would come, and the things would swing extremely, the pendulum would go in the other direction. You know, all throughout history, there's been this swinging now. So this is some of the argument about what you see with somebody like a Trump, who wouldn't have often qualified to even be on the stage. Now he's coalescing an energy, something we haven't seen, really, in our lifetime. It's a fascinating movement, and it's extremely powerful. And for many, very concerning. For others, extremely liberating. We shall see.
So, Bert, what is the polarity at work there?
Well, the polarity seems to be, if you were looking at structures of integration and structures of diversity. Now, I think we've got some other polarities at play, too, historically. So what we have done as a kind of a post-modern, post-technocratic society, where we have learned that our narrative around manifest destiny in kind of creating this country and all the things that have allowed it to become amazing have had a huge downside. So for the last, since the 60s, we've had a sensibility that we have to deconstruct a lot of that, and we have to allow all sorts of other narratives, especially ones that were previously marginalized or deprivileged in some way, like, you know, various kinds of ethnicities and races, gender, women, people with you know, different sexual orientations, looking at some of the problems of the military. So as those have been deconstructed a lot, and there has been a sensibility in the last many years in the culture of
the energies of sort of the white, military, male, yada yada, is wrong categorically. The other side is good. There hasn't been a sort of recovery and bringing along and revitalization of what's been good about all of that in the past. There's only been the demonizing, and now you're seeing in the personage of Trump a really big swinging back and saying, well, that's bullshit, we'll show you, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, how are we going to hopefully find a way to revalue what was the good sides of the modern era and the traditional era and not allow it to get so extreme? And who knows how that's going to turn out. Does that make sense? So one of the things, just on that note, and I know we've got to end here, is that this is bringing in another mental model. How many of you have ever heard of the drama triangle? Couple of you. So this is the idea. It was a model that was created in the 60s by a transactional analysis psychology movement, where in life it's a common thing when we're not at our best, when we're under-resourced and tired, frustrated, upset, whatever, we tend to go into drama. And by that, I'm either going to be in those moments a victim, a persecutor, or a rescuer. So think of just about anywhere you live in life with yourself or other people, we tend to though generally either oscillate between a victim and persecutor. That's my style when I'm not at my best. I'll either feel unfairly treated and then when I do, I'll kind of punch back. Or my psychotherapy practice will often be a rescuer and try to help somebody out and tell them what they need to do and it's not their fault and not empower them. The idea here is there are energies. This is the drama triangle where you've got a victim, persecutor, and rescuer. On both sides, that's the downside of the system, when we're not at our best in our drama triangle. When we're empowered, we're creators. Victim shifts to creator. A persecutor becomes instead a heartfelt challenger who wants somebody to do their best and standing for them. You can do better than that. I know you can do this. I've got your back. Come back when you figure it out. It's not putting somebody down. And rather than being a rescuer of somebody, somebody who can actually coach somebody to ask them questions about what will you do? How can you take a next step forward? So the way this plays out, I'm going to move through this a little bit. Go back here. I'm throwing so much at you guys, I know this. I'm trying to do way too much here. How do we trust that people, you know, I think what's happening in our system is people that, or demographics that have previously been marginalized, how can we bring this heartfelt challenge to these energies and trust that it's not blaming the victim? How can we be creative in supporting and helping people? A lot of what Donald Trump is saying is that we have been enabling this for so long, and the idea is so much that in this system, in the Western world, when we're being faced from things without, as well as things from other parts of the world, there's a lot of interesting energies out there that are coming at us and coalescing now. How will we be able to rightfully say no in a heartfelt, loving way with the upside of support and challenge is one of the main polarities. And this is what the drama triangle and the empowerment dynamic are trying to do, is how can we be creative, coaching challengers, not be victim-laden, persecuting rescuers. And it's going to be a tricky thing, but that's what we're being called to do on both sides here. So because you guys are philosophers, I wanted to throw in a couple of kind of political slides on where we have morphed to in terms of the evolution of social systems. Classic liberalism is the energy of the Enlightenment era. John Locke, for instance, one of the classic voices of this area, where it's all about freedom and liberty and people having the right to do whatever they want as long as it doesn't interfere with somebody else's liberty. So there was freedom and equality for people to do whatever. Over here, we've morphed into what's considered by many to be a more compassionate idea. Others believe not so much. where social liberalism has to do with the equality of outcomes as opposed to the equality of opportunities to do whatever you want. And both have a different kind of downside. This is critiqued by social liberalism as social Darwinism down here, not really allowing people to get a leg up when they deserve it and need it. The classic liberals see the downside of social liberalism as all the negative fantasies we have about socialist constructs, communism, and the downside of those. But we've evolved so that these are both in play in a big way now. It has a lot to do with racial issues. There are all sorts of up and downsides to this. We look at this polarity between white power and influence and black power and influence. Of course, we know the downside here. If we start in this poll, there's been slavery and racism as there has been everywhere. As we move forward here, we see the various polls. The upside of black power is resilience. One of the things that we see the upside of white power has been the creation, the emancipation of slavery, the emancipation of the great society in general, the creation of that. One of the things that's rarely talked about in our society is this here energy down here. So as a polarity, that's what we call a shadow. Now, I know that we are definitely out of time. I want to stop. All this is a lot of information, and let you guys digest this, maybe have a little bit of dialogue about all of this. So let's open this up a little bit to have a conversation in general and see what you guys make of all this.
We'd like the first question. I'm just curious about the Occupy movement that seemed to include the intellectual elite and minorities and labor union people. And I realize that lack of structure in that movement kind of condemned it from the start. What would be your comment about that?
I think they're really tuning into a big reality that when you look at the writings of Karl Marx in Das Kapital or the Communist Manifesto, that there will be, with a free market system, a coalescing of wealth and power at the top. It's basically like any system, things are going to be distributed. Even when you have a communist system, it turns out that. But there is then going to be a violent, upset revolt about the unfairness of that system. And I think people see the downside of the system as we have it now as being in the coalescences of wealth and power and corporations, the banking systems, and how it's set up to unfairly take advantage of workers who are the kind of bees who are sort of enslaved by the system to feed them.
One of the principles of it was it was nonviolent. So that wouldn't be an example of the reaction to the concentration of wealth.
Oh, the nonviolent side of it. Yeah. Well, it's not the typical communist side where it has to be violently overthrown. No, absolutely not. But, you know, we will see, you know, what it was able to do. Like, we look at the effects of what Occupy Wall Street had, and it's pretty uncertain at this point. Not a lot of results seem to have come from that.
Mm-hmm. That's
great. I was real impressed with the presentation. Thank you so much. I was wondering, I think I'm guilty, very, very much so, of cognitive dissonance. And so I've often thought, well, what would be some things that I could do for myself to mitigate that? And so I was just wondering your comments on that.
Yeah, that's a great question. For those of you unfamiliar with that term, cognitive dissonance is the experience we have when my already existing beliefs in how I think and feel about an issue, a person, anything, comes up against what we call disconfirming facts or data that kind of puts me into a dissonance between what I believe and now this information that's telling me otherwise. So it's a crisis. And usually the crisis is resolved in one way or the other. either I'm going to be informed, you know, what Piaget called, you know, like accommodation, you know, like, and allow myself to change with the new data, or I'll assimilate it into my already existing schemas and just be right about how I already was. And almost always what we do is we find a way to disconfirm the data that's coming in that would otherwise inform us. So to your question, how do I work with that? I think there's a lot about a willingness to kind of paradoxically have the faith to doubt the absolute truth of my already existing ideas, but that's a heroic act. Because what I've done in developing my ideology, my way of looking at the world, is I've taken membership in groups, let's say like this, or other organizations where I'm a standard bearer. If I'm a liberal, if I'm a conservative, a Christian, a Muslim, whatever it is, I have joined the cause with others like me, and we have been brothers and sister in arms. So I have to be willing, bravely, to risk the even ostracization of that from others who say, oh, I've lost it, you know, I don't get it anymore, I'm being confused. Okay. So there's a kind of heroic element of getting into that, and there's a quote I love around this thing that comes to mind. Any of you know the German writer Hermann Hesse? Okay, so he won a Nobel Prize in 1945 for a book called The Glass Heat Game. And he had several poems in it, and this one is called Stages, which speaks to me with your question. So he said, as every flower fades, and as all youth departs, as we all know here, so life at every stage, so every virtue, so our grasp of truth blooms in its day, but may not last forever. Since life may summon us at every stage, we must be ready for part of new endeavor. We must be ready bravely and without remorse to seek new light that old ties cannot give. In all beginnings dwells a magic force regarding us and helping us to live. So serenely, let us move to distant places, and let no sentiments of home detain us. The cosmic spirit seeks not to restrain us, but to lead us stage by stage to wider places. Even the hour of our death may send us speeding off to newer places, and life again will summon us to newer races. So be it, harsh. Bid farewell, without end. So that sensibility of being open and being reconfigured with information and not giving a damn about the old allegiances that don't serve us anymore, that ain't nothing. That's hard to do. But that's the spirit that comes to mind for me of cognitive dissonance. Yeah.
One of the criticisms of language is that it's dualistic. And
dualistic, and
you were asking me more or less to picture myself through opposites, language opposites, and I didn't feel that was a natural way to view myself or view the world. And I wonder to what extent you feel these polarities are real, and to what extent you think that we're forced to think in terms of language and the language polarizes us.
Sure. I think language can be a slave master, and it can harness us depending on our relationship to it. I think it can also be what I like to call a liberating structure. It kind of seems like something that doesn't fit. We usually think of freedom and liberty as unbounded, but sometimes there are structures like language, especially when employed well, that can lead to the most beautiful poetry, music, heartfelt sharing and connection with somebody else. I love you so much. You're so beautiful. I mean, that's not a confining thing. That's an opening, liberating thing. So I think how we use it, when we get lost in habitual patterns and it becomes rote and we're not creative anymore, then I'm a victim to my language that I use sometimes as a cudgel. And it's not, you know, the artist's pen or chisel in that way. That's my guess on language.
Anyone else? Well, if not,
not. You made reference, Bert, to Raphael's painting the School of Athens with Plato pointing up and Aristotle pointing down. And it just so happens that we have to present to you a Gauss Philosopher's Forum mug that has this very image on it. And
well,
recognizes you as one of our featured speakers.
Thank you, David.
And we also, as a token of our appreciation, will make a $25 donation to a charity of your choice.
Ah.
So just send me an email where you'd like that sent, and we will write the check.
I will do that. Thank you so much. Thank you, guys, for
Thank
listening.
You.